Welcome to High Truths on Drugs and Addiction, where national experts bring you facts and answers. I'm your host, Dr. Onit Lev, an emergency and addiction doctor who has served at the White House and practiced on the front lines. Right here on High Truths, you will learn from experts from around the globe and around all aspects of drugs and addiction. High Truths is more than a podcast. It's a movement to unite physical, mental, and addiction health. It brings innovations to connect public health, public safety, and prevention. Our discussions inspire people to implement programs that save lives. To grow this community of information and action, I hope you give us a 5-star review. Come visit me on hightruths.com. Today's episode is sponsored by Drug Free America Foundation, tackling the pervasive issue of substance use and its far-reaching impacts on individuals, families, and community. Drug Free America is supporting ISAC, the International Academy on the Science and Impact of Cannabis, doctors and scientists educating on the harms of marijuana. Hello again, High Truth listeners. Get ready for a de minimis conversation. I'm your host, Dr. Onit Lev. De minimis, as in the Latin expression and legal terminology meaning pertaining to minimal things. If you're involved in addiction treatment, recovery, or prevention, you probably never heard of de minimis. But you know who knows all about it? Drug traffickers. The de minimis loophole allows for importing drugs through the mail and across our border. The de minimis rule applies to the importation of goods under the value of $800. $800 is considered minimal and therefore can avoid the standard bureaucracy and taxes of foreign imports. When you re-enter the United States after your Italian vacation, you don't have to declare all your souvenir shopping to the U.S. Customs as long as you bought less than $800 worth of stuff. Is $800 fair? Let's compare what other countries consider de minimis. Germany, $167. Mexico, $50. Canada, $15. China, $7. United States, we're a superpower, so we have super de minimis. Beyond the airport lines, we have 4 million packages a day entering the United States. Most of them are not inspected, and 60% of them originate from China. What's in those packages? Sometimes it's an outfit made in China, and sometimes it's fentanyl. The de minimis issue has brought together the textile industry together with those concerned about stopping the supply of drugs. To learn more about de minimis, I reached out to Kim Glass. Kim Glass is the president and CEO of the National Council on Textile Organizations, NCTO. She also served as the appointed commissioner to the U.S.-China Economic and Security Review Commission. She has over 20 years of government policy experience. To learn more about Kim Glass and de minimis, check out the High Truth show notes. My conversation with Kim took place on January 28, 2025. Since recording this podcast, the news cycle has changed and I wanted to provide an update. In the past 3 weeks since inauguration, we've had on and off again 25% tariffs on Canada and Mexico. The tariffs are on hold as we're seeing increased military troops and other methods of securing the border. The fentanyl supply is drying up, and the public health and medical community should read the writing on the wall and prepare to connect people with addiction treatment who no longer have access to their drugs. As of today, the United States implemented a 10% tariff on China. The de minimis loophole remains open. It's still a problem for tax loss as well as fentanyl importation. The hope is that the de minimis loophole will close as soon as the Commerce Department develops a method to collect dues. Kim Glass, welcome to High Truths.
Thanks for having me, Dr. Lev.
So, we're very excited to have you here and want to start off by having the audience get to know you a little bit better. You are a lobbyist, is that right?
That is correct. I lobby on behalf of the U.S. textile and apparel industry who do domestic manufacturing across the 50 states.
So, tell us, how do you become a lobbyist? What made you want to do that?
Well, I've always worked on manufacturing and trade issues my entire career. I worked on Capitol Hill. I worked in the administration. And I love this industry a great deal. I believe in domestic manufacturing and their workforce and these what these companies are doing for these communities and these workers. And if we don't have a strong industrial base here in the United States, we're ceding our future to China and other nations in the world. So the other point that I would make is, you know, I like working for industries that have come through some of the most challenging economic environments. Textiles is one of them. And I'm a real, I'm really proud to fight for an industry that is a fighter, that has faced such predatory trade practices throughout the world. So it's an honor to be here today.
That's great. So explain to us a little, some of the basics, like what is textile? What is really the textile industry? How does the American public come in contact with this industry?
Well, the U.S. textile industry, despite the national news that we're an offshore industry, we're very much an onshore industry. We employ over 500,000 workers across our supply chain in the United States. So textiles is everything you wear, the fabric on your couch, the interior of your car, the airbag that protects your child, you know, the child seat in your car. I mean, we are everywhere. We make technical textiles. We make textiles in the apparel market. We're proud to outfit our U.S. military. We make textiles for Olympians. And so what you may think of as an old textile industry with Norma Rae has absolutely developed over the years. We make very technical fabrics that from parachutes that are other life-preserving materials. And we made PPE at the height of the COVID crisis to help our U.S. Hospital workers who are reusing PPE. And we were being asked by the Trump administration to convert our operations, and we were happy to do so.
Yeah, interesting. Actually, I worked during COVID as an emergency physician, and I think our PPE came from China too.
Which is sad. A lot of the Chinese supply chains broke down, and regrettably, some hospital staff had to use garbage bags as gowns and reuse N95 masks.
Oh, I wore the same mask for a week.
Yeah, terrible. Yeah, and that's not sanitary, but that's what you had to do to protect.
That's what I had to do. So what percentage, or can you even say, of the clothes that we wear? Because I think about textile, and you're saying clothing, I'm thinking Amazon, click, and it's brought to you from China. But so what percentage of the clothes that Americans wear are made in the United States?
So this is the sad story. Since China joined the World Trade Organization, as I mentioned, our industry is really the canary in the coal mine of industries where offshoring has been rampant. The part of our supply chain that we lost significantly was our apparel production. So we only, if you're looking at your closet, you're seeing a lot of Asia labels. About 2% of what we make is made in here in the United States. For our industry to survive, we export a lot of our fabrics and yarns to our Western Hemisphere trade countries who do the cutting and sewing for those garments that competes against the China supply chain. So this is how the industry has had to adapt over the years to be globally competitive.
So the raw material is coming from the United States and then sent overseas?
Sent to our free trade agreement partners, namely Mexico, Canada, Central America, where workers there cut and sew, which is the most labor-intensive portion of making a textile product that you wear, or, you know, mattress covers, or, you know, fabric that goes onto a couch that's very labor-intensive. And unfortunately, that part of the industry, a lot of it has gone offshore. We do have some producers here in the United States, and they're strong and are very resilient. But you're right, just in 1995, about 50% of what we had in our closet was American made. So this shows you the evolution over the last 20, 30 years because of China's distorted trade practices that have offshored key aspects of our industry.
I was surprised when I went to your website to learn how complex textile is. You think, you know, fabric, what I'm wearing, garments, but there are degrees and entire universities dedicated to textile and fiber engineering.
Absolutely. So the innovation starts from the fiber stage forward. So as you're a hospital, we're in the hospital system during the height of COVID, there's antimicrobial, antibacterial that is embedded in the fiber technology to protect the hospital worker, but also the patient. There's also technologies now embedded for our U.S. military that helps essentially hide them in any sort of combat. I mean, There's a lot of proprietary technologies our industry utilizes. So this is not your grandmother's industry. This is a highly innovated, highly automated, very technological industry. And we have whole universities like North Carolina State College of Textiles that leads a lot of this innovation work on behalf of our industry.
Right. So your national council and textile organizations, who do you represent? Are there people that are common names for Americans to be familiar with?
These aren't the names that are household names. There are companies like Milliken and Company and Parkdale that are very well known in the industry or very well known in the manufacturing sector. But I also represent some companies that do have names that Americans would like, Fruit of the Loom, Hanes Brands, Gildan, Under Armour, that are part of the U.S. supply chain.
So those names that we're familiar with, Fruit of the Loom, Hanes, Under Armour, are they all made in America?
There are significant portions of their operations that are made in America or are made in the Americas that are made of U.S. components. And some of them do have operations in Asia. But a National Council of Textile Organizations, we have a mission statement. Our organization represents the domestic industry. That means every day our industry association, including myself, we wake up to figure out how do we ensure we have a strong, resilient domestic supply chain. So I'm not here to represent interest in other areas of the world. Companies may have a global presence, but really to ensure the integrity of this supply chain, to grow it, to strengthen it, and preserve it.
Great. And so we're talking about textiles, but how is that at all related to fentanyl and drug trades? And how did you come to that connection as well?
Well, it's an interesting story. You never know in life where the road will lead. I have been working, and our organization have been working well over 5 years to close a trade loophole that is destroying my industry. We've lost 26 plants in the last 18 months, but is also facilitating precursors and illicit drugs to our doorstep called de minimis. And through our advocacy work, NCTO at one point, we were the only organization talking about this loophole. And we started getting phone calls from mothers, from fathers who had lost their child when a package arrived at their doorstep in the mail environment or FedEx or UPS, saying, I think this loophole that's hurting your industry has actually killed my family member. And I have never in my life, this fentanyl crisis, the illicit drug crisis that's happening in the United States, is our industry is not immune. We're in small towns that have been devastated. Our manufacturing industry has faced significant headwinds. But often in these rural towns, too, you'll see a wildfire of this poison killing our family members and our communities and hurting our workers at their industrial sites. So there's unique partnerships that sometimes exist that come out of crisis. And our industry and these partners, police, sheriffs, other drug addiction organizations, fentanyl family victim organizations, family members, who are all working together to try to close a loophole that's hurting all of us.
So let's understand this loophole a little bit better, the de minimis loophole. Can you explain that? And I did give the audience a little bit of a preview, but it's better to hear it from the expert.
Well, de minimis is meant to be products that are less than $800 that come into the United States. And it's called de minimis because it's intended to be minimal, that it should receive minimal scrutiny. It shouldn't have to pay a tariff into the United States. It's of minimal concern, minimal value. And in the 1930s, this is when de minimis was created, was when you went abroad or your family member went abroad, they brought a trinket back and they felt, we still get that paperwork on airlines, fill out a customs form. And if it's less than $800 at that time, it was less than a dollar, you didn't have to pay a tariff. It was not a burdensome requirement to the U.S. government. Now, fast forward to today, and you were mentioning you go online sometimes and you buy your clothing off Amazon, and we all click buttons and we have the instant gratification of a box arriving at my door within less than 24 hours of whatever the item is that we ordered. Anything that's less than $800 in the international mail environment or trucked over from Mexico and Canada doesn't have to pay a tariff, has minimal scrutiny. Now, how many de minimis packages are we receiving a day in the United States? It's 4 million. Last year, every day, it was 3 million. And so this is a wildfire out of control. Reporters have done deep analysis on de minimis. We know Chinese companies like Shein and Temu, their entire company is based on this economic model. I will manufacture this in some place like China, other area of the world. Some of these products are unsafe. Some of them are made with forced labor, and it's overwhelming the customs system. And it is easy for drug traffickers to use the path of least resistance into the United States marketplace to customers directly. So these packages come in, no one's scrutinizing them. They don't pay a tariff. The boxes are overwhelming. Everyone at CBP needs to process this. Their job is to facilitate trade and get it to our doorstep. And it's creating a crisis, unparalleled crisis. So the same, you may be ordering something off Amazon. Some child or a family member may be ordering something off Snapchat, whatnot, thinking that they ordered Adderall, thinking they ordered, you know, Ozempic or something. And they find out, you know, that a family member has received fentanyl in the mail. And it's a way to hide this drug paraphernalia coming in, the drug, illicit drugs coming in. And it also is facilitating precursors coming into the United States that end up making their way to Mexico that are made then into pills that come back into the United States. So we need to bring the volume of boxes down that are coming in. The only reason we have 4 million boxes a day this way is there's a carrot. You have like a trade incentive. I don't have to pay a penalty tariff out of China. I don't have to pay a tariff at all. The U.S. government rewards this offshore industry. And it's also facilitating these dangerous products. I didn't even mention I'm a U.S.-China commissioner. I just stepped down from the commission at the end of last year. But we had a whole hearing on this about pool filters that killed children that came in the de minimis environment, toys that made of toxic chemicals that nobody could even under the most direct analysis, couldn't figure out what those chemicals were.
I think Netflix did a whole series about makeup made in China that it was actually glue, put on some lipstick and can't get your, lips apart.
If your audience members are thinking about this right now and they're thinking, gosh, I don't know where this product was made, who made it coming in this way. Would you ever give your child like de minimis makeup or de minimis pacifier? You know, playing this out, given that it has no scrutiny, no information on it, and it's just coming to our doorsteps. I think often U.S. consumers think, I ordered something from a reputable company, that this must be safe. You know, this must be.
I don't think when you're clicking, you're probably going by how cheap it is. Right. And I don't know if you're really, everybody's looking at quality at that point.
Right. Well, I think it's a very basic tenet. You're right. I mean, I think there is, unfortunately, wages have gone down, relative. In the U.S., people are trying to buy more product than ever. We own more stuff than we've ever owned in our entire life. We have closets full of things that we don't wear, in order to have that fast fashion or whatever that product is. But I do think inherently U.S. consumers think that when they're buying something, it's safe. I should be able to use this, that the inherent responsibility is the company I bought this from at least is ensuring it's safe. It may be a cheap product, but at least it's safe.
The safety part is big. And, right now we made some flyers to give out at all the pharmacies and medical clinics, because 95% of online pharmacies are not following the rules and have the potential of selling you fentanyl instead of oxycodone or Adderall or Zyrtec. And that's, online pharmacies that are not reputable.
Isn't that unbelievable? Or I'm sure you have found online pharmacies that claim that they're Canadian pharmacy, but they're really a Chinese.
Right. Or Indian or multi. Right. Yeah. They're all clandestine for sure. So, so we understand how through the mail, through these systems, so many ways we're getting fentanyl in, hidden in all these boxes. How is that hurting your industry? Is it because you can't compete with those cheap prices that your plants are closing?
That's right. So China is taking advantage of the de minimis system. The China Morning Post did an article series that the Chinese government is doubling down on its investments in their own manufacturing industries to take advantage of this. They know it's a workaround to Trump's first term tariffs on China, that it gets rewarded into the U.S. government system. So half of the de minimis boxes are textile and apparel goods coming into the United States. And that's hurting CBP's ability to find the fentanyl and other products. If I had my magic wand, I'd get rid of de minimis altogether and say it should come in through normal entry with normal information, pay the tariff. The absurdity that we're flying in huge air cargo for little boxes to transport into the United States pre-labeled is ridiculous. That those items, if you got rid of de minimis tomorrow, would come in through normal channels and a ship through, you know, mass, like you'd be able to pull one or two items out of a larger container and test them. Versus what's happening right now. It's impossible for CBP officers to open 4 million boxes
a day. What percentage of all the fentanyl, and you may not know this, what percentage of, and I don't know, and I should know it maybe, of all the fentanyl that's coming in are coming in through those boxes?
Well, no one, it's a really great question. No one labels their box fentanyl. And when CBP
it's burritos. I've seen the burritos.
And they may label it a t-shirt and it's really a fentanyl. But yeah. Essentially, they have found, CBP has said this, Customs and Border Protection has said this in a number of statements. First, they have supported Congress moving forward with legislation immediately to address this loophole because of the high risk in this environment.
So, Kim, you're talking about how the de minimis loophole not just is bringing in fentanyl, hurting your industry, but what about other industries? We talked about the makeup, electronics, other ones. Are other industries joining you in this mission to get rid of this loophole?
You know, it's been fascinating because it's had me think about other industries that have been impacted because they reach out to us. So everything from domestic bike manufacturers who are making e-bikes, they're competing against imports coming in of batteries that are exploding. And so they're part of our coalition. We also represent, we have a Close the De Minimis Loophole Coalition. You can find it online. Bedding manufacturers, they have to meet certain flammability standards, but de minimis beds are coming in that are not meeting those flammability standards.
How about the pharmaceutical industry?
Yeah, the pharmaceutical industry, a lot of them have, through various advocacy groups, have said to us, yes, this is completely undermining. We have to follow various rules. We have, you know, stringency in our U.S. government system of requirements. And this is a workaround to the entirety of this. I've even talked to senior advocacy organizations where seniors are looking for lowest cost drugs, you know, that they can procure, and they're finding these online platforms, and it's like, oh, I can get my drug for 50% less, that may not even meet any standards whatsoever. And they're finding that, you know, some of the drugs actually are like a placebo effect, meaning they don't have it. It's just a candy pill. It's not really heart medicine. And
at least that won't hurt you. I'm worried about the people who have died because they bought medicine.
We have family victims where de minimis is how this came to their door. They have the receipts. Their family member procured it, whether it's like through an online platform, quote, in India, you know, yeah. Pain Percocet medication. Somebody in our coalition, her son couldn't get into the doctor. He thought this was the fastest way to get relief. And he died right next to his daughter, 2-year-old daughter. Yeah,
there's actually a real Adderall shortage. So if you find it online, you're all excited and then it ends up being fake.
Exactly. And I think we have such a system these days that we're like, hey, I order something, I should get it the next day. You know, why is there a backup? If I can get this quicker, this will help my child or this will help somebody in my family. And regrettably, the drug traffickers are using this to make money, to kill people. So when I have, I'm working with these drug organizations, and their view is also, if something helps the U.S. textile industry, it's going to help our fight on fentanyl and illicit drugs, because de minimis is basically a cheap way to get low cost, sometimes no cost products to the United States. And it's overwhelming the system. We have to get rid of the carrot, which is why our coalition has been calling on both the Biden administration, now the new Trump administration, please use your executive authorities to close de minimis. Doesn't require legislation. In fact, President Trump just signed an executive order on trade last week. And it has in that executive order that by April 1st, he is asking his administration on de minimis to come up with a plan to address the fentanyl crisis and the economic crisis as a result of this loophole. So the leader for that effort will be the newly confirmed Treasury Secretary Bessent, who has authorities over de minimis. Obviously, we're still pushing for legislation on the Hill, but given the crisis facing everybody, I think, given President Trump's strong trade stance, this to me is a no-brainer to get done.
That's important. And Greg, that just shows how connected you are. You know exactly where to go and where to move this. So let's talk about this solution, closing the loophole. And what does that mean? How does that affect my Amazon clicking?
So you, no worries. You will still be able to order products off of Amazon. Those products will have to come in through normal entry to the United States. So it's not going to slow down your ability to get your t-shirt or new necklace or whatever you ended up ordering off Amazon. Amazon has warehouses across the United States. In fact, they have a warehouse just right by my home, about 5 miles. But what it will require is when those shipments come in, they have to come in through normal entry and they have to pay a tariff. President Trump has talked about, I want to utilize tariffs to address some of predatory trade behaviors, to address the fentanyl crisis. And I want to onshore industries. People who make products here in the United States should be rewarded to make products here. We shouldn't be giving a free trade agreement to China for no reason. And that's what de minimis is.
So that t-shirt would cost maybe 25% more?
So the tariff on a t-shirt is 16%, a cotton t-shirt. And so remember, the tariff is not on the sale price. So let's say you bought the t-shirt for $10 and it's not 16% on top of the $10, making it whatever that math is. It's 16% on the import value. So that import value for Amazon, they may have paid $1 for that t-shirt, but they mark it up to $10 to sell it online. The tariff is only applied to the $1 import price.
Right. Although that will be passed on to the consumer.
Well, there's been a lot of analysis about that. What happened during the Trump round one tariffs on China? And they found that it had a nominal effect to consumer prices. So everybody who's opposed to de minimis reform will often throw out, this is going to hurt consumers or low income people. But any real analysis that has been done on tariffs, which, by the way, the Trump administration, his first administration, applied 25% tariffs on goods. I'm only talking about paying a regular tariff, 16%, that it had a nominal impact on consumer pricing. So a lot of retailers do end up absorbing that cost. And the reason they do that is it's a highly competitive retail market. There are so many online stores right now. There's so many retailers who are being hurt by de minimis. and are going out of business.
But if that's such a small amount, 16% of the $1, is that going to help you, the American textile industry?
It will, because we obviously make duty-free product here in the U.S., right, because we're U.S.-based. And we also work with our free trade agreement countries that get a 0% tariff into the U.S. market as long as they use U.S. or regional components. So, yes, the margins in this industry, it's a hyper-competitive industry. So anytime you're giving China or Asia a benefit for nothing, while we've agreed to free trade agreements with our Western Hemisphere partners, it undermines the co-production chain that we have that is directly competing against China, Asia.
Now, how does that help regarding fentanyl? Because you were saying like, oh, we can't go through 4 million boxes a day. But I don't know. Somehow I feel like we should. Sorry. I mean, to save one life.
No, please know I'm in full agreement on that.
Yeah.
CBP is down for trade officers, people who are actually inspecting the trade coming in. They're projecting a 5,000 worker deficit. I mean, there's a retirement cliff that's happening within that agency. And in fact, it's happening across the federal government. So they don't have the resources to do this. They have a few people at some of these sites, and they do through other targeting methodologies like online, trying to figure out algorithms to look at certain packages that are coming in. But there's no way to facilitate this. So why would a solution for U.S. textiles on this issue help with fentanyl and finding fentanyl in the mail? You have 4 million boxes coming in today, small little tiny packages coming in, because it's a way to game the system. The U.S. government gives you a reward for that. You get duty-free benefit. You get no scrutiny. It doesn't have to have any information with it. Those boxes will go away if you close the de minimis loophole, or they will substantially go down. They will go back into a regular cargo system, have to have all the applied information, have to pay a tariff, get rid of the carrot that's creating this sort of FedEx, you know, air cargo overnight of just de minimis packages, which will make finding fentanyl and precursors easier to find. Being a CBP agent these days is extremely difficult. We import a lot into the United States, a lot of things, and you have to find the needle in the haystack. But we make it harder with this trade provision, because you're not only trying to find a needle in a haystack, but you have all these tiny little boxes to go through versus opening up a container and saying, okay, here's like a whole assortment of shoes. You know, is there anything in this? I can pick out one or two things or look at the container as a whole. So this is what de minimis has created.
Interesting. So I know there are 13 Republican attorney generals who signed on to this, including Ashley Moody, now is in the Senate, taking Senator Rubio's old position in Florida. Are you gaining a lot of support?
We are. There's been strong bipartisan support in the House and Senate on doing something. These 13 attorney generals, all Republican attorney generals, asked President Biden to use his full authorities to close de minimis. That helped spur an additional letter from over 130 House Democrats asking Biden to use his authorities to close de minimis. And so there's, I think, an overwhelming support for having President Trump do that. We look forward to engaging with the new administration, and some of our cabinet officials are just getting confirmed, asking them to use their authorities to stop this bleeding.
That's great. And you're hoping for April.
I'm hoping for April. We will do everything possible to educate everybody by the April timeframe because of the crisis. And one last point that is really important for people to understand is President Trump's talking about levying tariffs on other countries, you know, and he's developing his plan. Hey, if you don't follow the rules, I'm going to tariff you, or maybe I'll have an across-the-board tariff on everybody, you know, to help pay for tax cuts and or other priorities, or to address other priorities. The problem with that is if you keep de minimis open and you levy tariffs on everybody, these packages will overwhelmingly come in through de minimis because people are going to find a way to work around the tariff trade penalties. So trade penalties are useless without closing a loophole, this loophole.
And if it's closed, does that mean I have to declare my souvenirs next time I go on a foreign vacation?
No. What we are asking for specifically is to close de minimis for all e-commerce commercial transactions, but leave it open for you're traveling abroad and you want to bring back a vase or, you know, grandma from Canada wants to send you a sweater. That's fine. It is. That's how de minimis was intended to be, but not for, you know, all commercial sales, all e-commerce sales.
Eliminating the loophole, that automatically implies that for our U.S. citizens who bring things over, they get an exemption?
Right. So as long as you would still get the customs form on the plane, or you bring back stuff that's less than $800 per individual item, you check the box, yes. I mean, unless you're bringing back some Oriental rug. but yeah, it would not hurt people from going abroad and receiving a tariff duty-free benefit. But what would it stop? Yeah, it would stop online commercial sales. You know, that are skirting our tariffs and are skirting our U.S. laws.
Yeah. So who has opposition to this? What does Amazon or UPS say about this?
Express shippers oppose true de minimis reform. They'll say they're for reform, but it's really something that's kind of, you know, we'll give you more information on de minimis shipments, but we still want the benefit, meaning duty free and all of that. And there's been whole business models created to facilitate these packages from abroad. So that is, it's a small group of organizations, some e-commerce companies that oppose true reform. But the overwhelming sentiment is, it has been hard to find a group who really opposes our point of view. In fact, the more that I'm talking to various groups, whether it's retailers, whether it's other domestic manufacturers like flatware companies who are going out of business because of imported de minimis flatware, bicycle manufacturers. I mean, the U.S. economy and our retail community are being hurt significantly. And as part of our advocacy efforts on this, I was in the Wall Street Journal and New York Times, have been in multiple media outlets. The more I'm talking about this, the more families have been reaching out to me. This is how this came in the mail. I've also gone to the CBP Targeting Center, and what they're finding when they did a mission at the LAX recently to look at de minimis packages, mm-hmm. they were overwhelmed with the hundreds of pounds of precursors that came in this environment. They were also overwhelmed when they opened pre-addressed envelopes that had dummy return addresses. And they were in a U.S. Postal Service envelope. And it may have a dummy address of Chicago, but already addressed to somebody to receive a fentanyl pills. So it's coming in from China, other areas of the world, and these pallets of pre-addressed envelopes looking like it came from the United States, but it came from China. And they're finding even that the drug traffickers didn't even pay for the postage. It's fraudulent postage, but it still got through. And, you know, it's still getting through in these other, you know, so, and that was just one recon mission, you know, recently of a period of time, you know. So people who are trying to game the system or trying to hurt us, drug dealers who are trying to make a lot of money and take advantage of this, they'll pick the path of least resistance. And that's what they're doing in the de minimis environment.
Wow. And you're saying that the shortage of agents, if this closes, will they be able to handle this volume?
I absolutely believe so, because the volume of packages will come down this way. You won't need as many agents opening up boxes, even though it's impossible to open up 4 million boxes a day. And instead, putting agents at our key ports of entry, for container ships, looking at those packages. So I don't think we should be decreasing the number of Customs and Border Protection officers. Also, as part of President Trump's plan, he's trying to collect more revenue, right? So you're going to find trade fraud of people who are trying to manipulate the system and not pay the full tariff, whether that's de minimis or another way. So we really need stepped up customs trade enforcement.
I bet he builds up CBP as well.
I think that's part of his. He announced as part of his executive order, external revenue service to help collect tariffs. That's CBP's job. So he's clearly noting we need to be doing this a lot more and better.
And, you know, this is not a live podcast. We're recording this now, January 28th. By the time it airs, who knows how many other executive orders and changes will happen. Things are moving fast. So your message to President Trump is to go ahead and get that signed by April 1st. And what's your message to the American consumers?
American consumers is buyers beware. Just because you order something online, you may think it's compliant with our laws here in the United States, whether that's product safety laws or forced labor laws. It's a dangerous environment, the de minimis environment. And a lot of these packages are arriving at our door with no scrutiny. So think about the things that you purchase for your child, your elderly grandparent, and really, really assess how you're purchasing those items. And also, don't fall victim to if we just have people pay regular tariffs, that's going to skyrocket the cost of my jeans and I won't be able to afford it. And that is totally something we need to dispel. There's a reason this industry has been offshored. We are a deflationary industry. We used to pay more for a pair of jeans in the 1990s than we're paying on average today. This industry has gone largely offshore to some of the worst places in the world. So, I think people need to understand helping pay a tariff levels the playing field. It's not going to hurt costs substantially at all. It's really pennies on a dollar. It will help reshore critical industries like ours and also address this drug crisis that we're all facing. It's facing the manufacturing industry. It's facing our families. It's facing our communities. And we need to do everything possible.
Yeah. I'd be willing to pay a few more pennies on the dollars to save even one life from fentanyl.
Exactly. Same. There's no question.
Well, Kim, thank you so much for joining us. Textile industry is very obviously very lucky to have you. And good luck with your mission. And buy American, right?
Buy American. Thank you so much for having me on. I really appreciate it.
Thank you. Thank you for listening to High Truths on Drugs and Addiction, where you learn from experts from around the globe and around all aspects of drugs. This week's episode would not be possible without the generous support of our sponsor. A sincere and warm thank you to Drug Free America Foundation. Visit dfaf.org and ISAIC, the International Academy on the Science and Impact of Cannabis. That's IASIC1.org. High Truth's producer is Dave Rivas from Davey Boy Productions. I'm your host, Dr. Onit Lev. We hope we brought your day a little bit more High Truths.